Good afternoon. So, last time, we finished up talking about how the operating system can communicate device by talking about something called direct memory access. And in this scheme, the device controller could read or write directly to device driver buffers. So the OS would supply the physical address of the buffer, you know, via the magic memory scheme we mentioned before, and would still use that magic memory scheme to communicate with the device in order to figure out, like, had it read or written things correctly, what was happening, you know. So we still use, you know, sort of magic memory to check device status and give commands generally, but data transfer works differently. And we mentioned that this, you know, avoided some extra copying. It was generally a lot faster because the CPU wasn't doing copying for devices where we have to move a lot of data, like hard drives and networks, or other devices, not so worthwhile. So, and we also mentioned that, well, we could maybe, if we're really clever with this scheme, we could tell the device controller, which remember is the hardware, to write directly where the application wants. And I said we have to be really clever because it turns out there's a lot of obstacles to doing this in practice, but maybe we could achieve that. Then we started talking about file systems. And to talk about file systems, we need to have some notion of how do we communicate with a hard drive or an SSD. We mentioned the interface was the sector. So this is the hardware unit that we can read or write. Reads, writes. And we have to read or write whole sectors. And this is going to constrain how we can organize our data on the disk when we're talking about our file systems that divide up the disk into files. And we looked at one simple file system design called FAT. So FAT divided the disk into clusters, and this was the software unit, you know, of one or more sectors. So you're, you know, obeying the constraint, we decided we didn't want to necessarily need to do what the hardware did, so we had a separate unit. And we needed to get the file's data, we needed to represent that somehow. And our choice was that we have files be a linked list of cluster numbers that would be, you know, where the data is. So we needed to store that linked list somewhere. And that means we needed a bunch of next pointers. So we stored that in the file allocation table, which was this big array with one entry for every cluster, and that had the next pointers. And we also used this for some other purposes. For example, we used it to store what clusters were free. Now, this got us the data for the files, but we also needed sort of metadata, sort of like file name, the exact size. We know how many clusters it is, but like that doesn't tell us how much of the last cluster is used, you know, times, etc. And where the file started, given some sort of name, and we stored these in directory entries. So our directories, we stored like files, but they contained a list of these directory entries, and that's how we actually took a name from a user and converted it into something which we could usefully look up as a file. So today, after some logistics, I'm going to talk about this disk interface more. Sort of what, how do hard drives work, what's the interface the OS gets to them, and also how do SSDs work. But before I do that, any questions about things we covered last time? The question is, how does the OS mount a file system at boot or during runtime? So we haven't talked about mounting yet, which is perhaps a rather of an omission. So the OS is going to need to have some table of what file systems are active at during runtime. We're just adding to that table, and that table is going to have to be used somehow when an application calls open. And we mentioned in FAT we had a header with general information about the about what's on the disk, disk contents, and that's going to be a common thing in most file systems. So that's how we'll get the info, you know, the setup info about like where's the root directory and so on. As for at boot time, that's usually kind of special because something has to load the OS. And that is something that I don't have the details of memorized, but that's sort of a special case. But something has to load the OS and it has to communicate to the OS, here's where the first file system is, so the OS can actually load. Does that answer your question, kind of? Okay. So, some logistics first, then. So, a lot of people have been asking for a paging assignment extension. So, generally, I don't like giving late extensions for assignments like this because I don't want students to be playing a guess what the real due date is game with the due dates I have listed. And we already gave an extension earlier, you know, and maybe I consider doing something like this if we had some notice. I think in retrospect, probably when I gave my extension after spring break, I probably should have done it till Friday, even though that kind of puts the paging and FAT assignments close together, which is why I didn't do that. But I don't think it makes sense to try to change that, you know, this late because, you know, students started the assignment on time, and I don't want you to sort of play a guessing game when you're planning, when is the assignment really due? I certainly do wish, and this was the cause of, you know, request for this, is that we had more efficient and effective office hour help. We were, you know, we're kind of used to how do we do office hours virtually, and we're trying to get all our TAs on board, and some of them have real life things that have come up and made them less available than they used to be. So yes, we have been kind of struggling with that. Hopefully we're going to be improving. But our general assumption for assignments is that you should be able to complete the assignment without office hour help. And if you are getting office hour help, that you don't wait till the last day for your first set of questions, which some people seem to be doing, because you should expect that it might take a bit of time to get answers, even with in-person office hours, when everyone's doing the assignment at the same time, and you have, there's going to be stuff to do to resolve your problem. If you had some particularly difficulty to work on the assignment, for example, I know some people have had like computer or internet availability issues, needed to suddenly move, illness, and so on. I do case-by-case extensions. Contact me privately. Like, that's a very reasonable thing. Also, the late policy still applies. I know some of you may have not looked at the late policy. Basically, you should check the webpage for like the firm description. It's something like 90% after 3 days, 80% up to 5 days, which I think is pretty generous. And given that we have a little bit of a buffer before the FAT assignment, I would encourage you to take advantage of if you have not completed the assignment. And speaking of office hours, generally, hopefully we're getting more efficient. Like we're learning to like switch between students rather than when to avoid spending so much time with one student without helping others and other things like that, which will make us more efficient. There are things you can do that will hopefully help us make office hour more efficient. So one thing is we have a place for you to write a task description. It would be great if something useful was in there, not like paging or help. So we can potentially group students with related problems together and save some time for everyone. When you're talking to one of us, it would be nice if before we talk to you, you've done some work that will make our time with you more efficient, like simplifying the test cases that you can cause the failure, like figuring out what's the simplest thing I can do to make this fail, and working on figuring out, like, at least, you know, what part of your code is running, so we don't have to, as has sometimes happened, go to you and say, okay, I see it's failing, I want to know if you're, you know, if this is happening or not, but you have no debug prints, so all I see is that it hangs. You know, do some work to figure out what your code, you know, what parts of your code are running, so we have more information and we don't have to like go back and forth as many times. That should make it more efficient for everyone, especially if you're spending time waiting anyways. This is something you can do while you're waiting. That should make it faster when you're done waiting and faster for everyone else. Also, like, we have office hour time throughout the week, so please try to make more use of time that is not right before assignments are due. I mean, these are things that probably will apply to future assignments that would be help us be more efficient. So questions on logistics issues. So, a brief note on the next assignment, which is FAT. So, we're going to have you read from a FAT file system. Now, because we're not going to like send you all hard drives, we're going to have you read from what we call a disk image, which is a regular file that you'll put somewhere, which is the contents of a hypothetical hard drive or SSD. And we're going to have you use the real version of FAT using the specs from Microsoft for this. Those specs specifications specify multiple versions of FAT, variants of FAT. We're going to have you implement the FAT32 version, and that's the only one we care about. You could implement others, but we're not going to test them. Some things to note, I gave a sort of an overview of FAT, which omitted some details which come up in this assignment, so you should pay careful attention to make sure you're paying attention to what the specification says about these details. To make sure you get them right. So one thing is that there is a mapping from cluster numbers to location on disk. I kind of suggested that it starts 0, then 1, then 2. It's actually more complicated than that. Check the specification carefully so you don't get confused. Why am I not getting the right data? That might be why. Also, I imply that the end of a file in the file allocation table was represented by -1. That's a possible value for it, but it's not the only or the most common value used for that purpose. Is it true that the FAT assignment has historically been the most challenging? Generally, students have reported the FAT and paging assignments as the most challenging. It's not clear what the rank order is between the two. Paging seems to have a lot more variability in how hard people find it compared to FAT. But something like that, as to answer your question, is it true that it's been historically the most challenging? That fine? Okay, so with some logistics out of the way like this, let's talk about hard drives. And you might, when you're starting out, ask me, why are we talking about hard drives? Everyone buys SSDs these days, and SSDs are the future, and you might be right. We're going to talk about hard drives partly because of history. Hard drives are what file systems are designed for, and a bunch of the decisions we'll be talking about make a lot more sense when you realize they were designed with hard drives in mind. Also, currently, hard drives, if you want storage that's accessible all the time, are probably the most cost-effective way of doing that in terms of cost per gigabyte. Also, because of this history of hard drives being what file systems are designed for, solid-state drives imitate hard drive interfaces, even though they work very differently, and even though sort of a natural interface to the underlying hardware would look very differently. So they're designed just to look like a hard drive to the OS. So it'll be useful to know how hard drives work to have that in mind. So here's a picture, a photograph of a hard drive. This is the insides of a hard drive that you might put inside a desktop or similar. And there's several components. So most notably, we have these platters. You can only see the top one, but there's actually a stack of these. So there's another one below, a couple more below there. And these are flat disks that store data magnetically. And when this hard drive is operating, these platters are basically continuously spinning. And along with these platters, we have this arm. Right now, it's not in the disk, but when the disk is operating, it will be moved to be placed over some part of these platters while they're spinning. At the end of this arm is a head. And this is the actual component which reads or writes magnetic signals on the platter. They're actually very, very tiny at the tip of this. And the idea is that the arm moves to where the data is, and the platters move over the heads, and that's where the reading and writing of data on the hard drive happens. Okay. So the basic operation of this is that, you know, based on what needs to be read, these heads will be moved, and they'll wait until the right data goes over the heads because as the platters spin. So questions about sort of what's in this picture? What's going on here? Okay, so let's talk about sort of the organization of the data on the hard drive. So as I said, we have a bunch of platters. Each of these platters has data. And if the heads are sitting in a particular location, they're all sort of connected together. So there's a sort of cylinder of data that they might read without moving. And that's called a cylinder. So that's sort of a subsection of the disk. And we have this name for one of the platter's information in the cylinder, which we call a track. And on that track, we have sectors, which basically correspond to the actual sector of data that the OS could read or write. I'm sort of showing the sectors all together. It might be a little more complicated in a real modern hard drive, but this is basically the arrangement of the data. And historically, this was exposed to the operating system. Like the operating system would say, oh, go to cylinder 15, track three, you know, track number that, and this sector, and would actually tell the disk what to read or write. In terms of that, this is not what we do anymore. We use that scheme where we have numbers for the sectors, kind of like we had numbers for clusters, in fact. But thinking about things this way helps us understand what the performance of the hard drive is. And there's three important things for performance that we can kind of glean from this picture. So if we want to read a particular part of the disk, one thing we need to worry about is what we call seek time, that we need to go to the cylinder where the data we're actually looking for is. And if the head is not in the right part of the disk, this takes time because we physically have to move that arm to the correct location. And if we have to move it most of the way on the disk, typically this takes like 5 to 10 milliseconds, depending on the hardware. Now that's actually really fast for physically moving something with very high precision. It's incredibly fast from a, you know, perspective of what you can do with actual physical things. But from a software perspective, it's actually pretty slow. If we think of our schedulers, we were talking about having like a 1 millisecond time slice for processes. We can fit a lot of these in the time it takes us to get to the right place on the disk. Now, once we end up getting to the correct cylinder, we might have to wait for the platters to rotate to get the actual sector, like maybe this blue thing, that we want to read from them. And how long this takes varies a lot. I have a sort of a quote here of like 2 to 8 milliseconds or so. this depends on how fast the disk is rotating, and there's actually quite a lot of variation in how fast disks rotate. So if you have a slower disk, it uses less power, maybe it's more reliable, and it's a lot quieter. If you have a faster one, it's a lot louder and probably uses more power, but it's faster. And that's why we have this big range of time depending on what your disk does. Now, finally, once we've waited for the correct thing to go under the head, we have to actually transfer the data. And that depends basically on how densely the data is stored on the disk. And that might vary between parts of the disk, because if we think of the outside of the disk, the head is going over it faster, so maybe we can read data faster, depending on how the disk stores things. And this gives us sort of a transfer time. Typically, it's going to be 50 to like 100 or maybe 150 megabytes per second once we actually get to the right place. But this is, you know, typically the big things we're concerned about are going to be this seek time and rotational latency. And this gives us some control, actually. Like, we can't do much about the transfer time, like the actual speed at which we can read data once we get there, but we can do things from a file system perspective that control the seek time and the rotational latency, because the seek time is going to be lower if we have to move the heads by less. This 5 to 10 milliseconds is assuming we need to move most of the size of the disk. If we only have to move a teeny bit or none, well, that's going to be faster. If we don't have to wait for things to rotate, if they're like stored next to each other and we can read them all at once, that's going to be faster. So what this is going to tell us as a file system designer is that really we want to arrange to have the things that we're reading from the disk be adjacent or at least close by to each other to minimize the seek time and the rotational latency. The question is there a head for each platter, and can the heads move independently? So there is a head for each platter, because physically we have to put something above the data to read it, and like actually like really, really close, like microns away. My understanding is that generally they do not move independently, probably because it's hard enough to make the arm work with very high precision without trying to worry about having multiple of them right next to each other. Other questions? Okay, so this seek time, rotational latency, and transfer time, so that's most of what we have to worry about when we think of disk performance. Although for completeness, there's some other things that affect how fast we can read from the disk, but they're mostly things that we're going to have a hard time controlling much. So one thing is queue time, that typically, well, I mean not typically, but often, we're going to have multiple things we're trying to read or write from the disk, and the read or write needs to wait in line, and that's going to vary based on what we do and what order we actually do reads or writes in. And as we'll learn later, often we're going to have multiple things that we're trying to read, and something needs to decide what order to do them in. And also, there's some extra overhead we're not talking about, because we have to talk to the disk controller, and the disk controller talks to the disk, so that's going to add some extra time. Okay. So, I showed you this notion of cylinders, heads, and tracks. Yeah, and as I said, historically, the OS knew the location of data on the disk. This is not the case anymore. These days, hard drive basically expose opaque sector numbers. They just have numbers, and that's all you get. And this is nice for hard drive makers, because they can do whatever they want with those numbers. And the sort of the idea is that maybe they know better than the operating systems where to put data. Also, this is the same interface that's used for things like SSDs, where the notions of cylinders, heads, and tracks would be very weird in the don't really have any hardware analog. Now, typically, even though these are opaque separate numbers, meaning you can't know what they really mean, there's a typical pattern that still makes them useful when we're thinking about that seek time and rotational latency. So one thing is that typically lower sector numbers are going to be in the faster part of the disk, assuming that the way data is stored makes some parts of the disk more or less dense, basically. And more importantly, adjacent sector numbers are likely to be adjacent on the disk. So this means, or nearby. So, if their sector numbers are close together, they're probably in the same cylinder and so on. So this means that as an operating system or a file system maker, we're going to try to keep things that we access at the same time in nearby sector numbers. And that's going to lower our seek time and rotational latency. Even though we're not going to know precisely how to make sure things are in the same cylinder or anything like that, we'll at least know they're in nearby cylinders with high probability because the sector numbers are nearby. But the actual mapping is going to be up to the disk controller, and it can do technically whatever it wants, but it's going to realize that we know adjacent sector numbers should be used for related data, so it's going to try to have that, nearby sector numbers be physically close on the disk. So if we have these obeyed sector numbers, how do we talk to the disk controller? And it's going to take sort of a list of requests. And basically, we're going to say, hey, I want to read or write these sectors with this data. Typically, they'll use DMA. So we'll just point to the data that we want to write or where we want to read into. And they'll typically have a queue of requests. So they'll have a list of here are the things I want to do. And the disk controller will typically decide on the order to process these in. And this means that the disk controller can look at where the data is actually stored and decide, okay, these things are together. I can move the head once to read all of them rather than moving the head as much more to read other things in between. So I can reorder them to make that happen. But we also, when we do this, let the OS specify some restrictions. So there's going to be some way of saying, hey, I know I'm asking you to do all these writes, but write this before you write that, even if it means being slower. We'll learn when we talk about reliability that this functionality here is important for supporting that. So, questions about this disk interface? So, reliability is basically a big concern with hard drives, and hard drives, turns out, often aren't really that reliable. So I should probably see if there's maybe some good data more recently, but Google did a huge study in 2007 where they looked at the reliability of all the hard drives across their data centers. And Google was trying to save money and could deal with disks failing in software, so they heavily utilized cheap disks. So they bought cheap disks that you might get in a cheap desktop or laptop in bulk, and they probably use them way, way, way more than you would in your typical laptop or desktop. So maybe these results aren't completely typical, but the failure rate is really high. So they observed an annualized failure rate, meaning if you take a look at a particular hard drive over a year, what's the chance that it fails? They got 1.7 to 8.6%, depending on age and what model of disks they were looking at. And the definition of failure they were using for the statistic wasn't that part of the data gets broken or glitches. It was that the disk needed to be replaced. So these are real serious failures. So that's a really high failure rate. And you might say, okay, well, it sounds like these cheap disks, the manufacturers, weren't doing what they were supposed to do to, you know, make that failure rate better. But this is in spite of the disk actually doing a lot to hide a lot of errors and mitigate errors. And one way we could tell this is that they recorded how many of the working disks had something called reallocated sectors. And they discovered 9% did this reallocated sectors. And what does that mean? Well, when we have a disk, one common way disks fail is we have our platter and some part of the platter becomes damaged, like physically damaged, and stops being able to hold those magnetic signals. And this is going to affect all the sectors that go over there. Now, as a first defense against this, hard drives actually store a sector's data in a way which has redundancy. So it can handle little bits of damage, but if there's a large enough damage, we'll end up not being able to, you know, read or write the data for a particular part of the disk. And one approach that, you know, disks originally did for this is that you could just say, when the OS tries to read or write that, sorry, doesn't work, and make it the operating system's problem. But that's generally not what hard drives do. Instead, the disk controller is more intelligent about this. Since the disk controller is using these sector numbers anyways, they can do what we call sector remapping. Whenever there's a part of the disk that's physically bad, they detect that and use a different part for those sectors. And to make this work, you know, they're going to set aside extra space for replacing bad sectors. Typically at manufacture time. And they're also going to have to do some work to somehow store this mapping for all the parts of the disk that went bad that they needed to find a replacement for. And this is something that is in the disk controller. So the OS doesn't know about this. This is just something which it's going to do for the OS to make the disk seem more reliable. And Google found that, you know, this hit a lot of failures. So like 9% of their disks would have failed if we didn't have this. So it is actually pretty important. And it also means that, you know, there's sort of information loss that we know that nearby sector numbers are probably close together on the disk, but that's not guaranteed. And this is a reason why we might want to rely on the disk controller, like deciding what order to read or write sectors in. You just want to give it like a list of requests to do. And from the OS's perspective, sort of a conclusion you can come to this is that if you have multiple things you want to read or write eventually, like the disk controller knows more about where those things actually are and how to read them efficiently. So you should just try to request them together so the disk controller can do its thing, rather than, like, say, if we think about fat, like read the first sector, read the fat, read the second sector, read the fat. We don't want to do that sort of sequential thing. We'd like to like get the list of locations at all at once and then ask to read all of them together so the disk can minimize our seek time and based on its knowledge of where it's actually storing everything. So questions about our sector remapping? So overall conclusions we get from how hard drives work, that there's sort of two things that file systems can do that's going to help us use disk effectively. So one thing is that we want to do contiguous or at least nearby reads or writes, that, you know, we'd like to read or write things that are in close sector numbers and do multiple of them together so we can get the best performance. And, you know, we've we're going to see some file system designs for this. We've already seen some things which are going to help us with this, like read ahead is a way to help us do, you know, multiple reads and writes at once and possibly do contiguous ones if we're lucky to store the data together. And we're going to see file system designs that are going to help us do this sort of later on when we talk about file systems that are a little more complicated than that. So that's about hard drives. So any questions about hard drives? So what we're going to move on to is we're going to talk about solid state disks. And solid state disks are going to provide the same hard drive interface. So we're going to queue reads and writes, just like we do with hard drives. But the hardware to store the data is going to be very different. So here's sort of my high-level view of what's inside a solid-state disk. So this is the disk controller up here. So that's going to be connected to the processor and OS. And the disk controller is going to be actually very complicated. So it's going to typically have a CPU inside it to handle its complicated logic and its own RAM to run the program that the complicated program that's running on there. And that controller is responsible for translating between how these NAND flash chips store data and how hard drives work and providing the hard drive interface to the processor and OS, even though that's not how the NAND flash chips work. And I said it includes a CPU. Sometimes the CPU is like surprisingly powerful, like on the order of like a really cheap smartphone inside an SSD. So let's talk about what these flash chips support. And these flash chips, in many ways, are a lot better than hard drives. The biggest thing is that they don't have any moving parts. They're just electrical. And basically, they store bits using something kind of like capacitors. And in some ways, reading from them is similar. We don't have to move any parts, so we don't have seek time or rotational latency. We still have to read in big chunks, so they call the unit you read on a flash pages instead of sectors, but this is typically like 4 to 16K, and that's sort of the unit the hardware can read it. And so far, that just seems like, oh, it's not actually that different from hard drives, and reading is going to be faster because we don't have to seek or rotate, so it just seems better. But where things get complicated is when we talk about how writing works. So the flash chips are write once between erasures. So there's this erase operation which clears out a section of the flash known as an erasure block. And basically, you can think of that as resetting it to like all zeros, and then we can flip those bits to ones after we do that, but we can't flip them back to zero without erasing the entire block. So that's kind of inconvenient because it turns out these erasure blocks are going to be quite a bit larger than the single sectors we can write on a disk. They're often going to be like 256K or maybe even megabytes. And that's sort of the minimum unit we can overwrite. And that's sort of very inconvenient for providing the hard drive interface. Like our file system with hard drives is used to writing a single sector or maybe a couple sectors at a time. We can't physically do that without rewriting a much bigger part of the flash. And we're going to have a solution where we end up, you know, not doing that. And to make this worse, you might say, well, it's just a performance problem. We're just going to write more than we need to. So sure, let's just erase, you know, if we want to write, overwrite one sector, let's just erase the whole block around the sector and rewrite it. And that would work, except that these flash has some physical limitations as far as how much you can erase each block. And typically, you can only erase the blocks tens of thousands to maybe hundreds of thousands of times before it starts failing. And this is actually kind of a big problem for doing that direct mapping. Because if we think of, for example, the FAT on the FAT file system, we're going to overwrite parts of that all the time, because basically every time we write a file, we're going to have to change parts of the FAT. The FAT probably fits in like only a small number of these erasure blocks, maybe one or two. And we could easily go over 10,000 or 100,000 times over a couple years on, say, a laptop. And then the FAT would stop working and we lose all our data. And that would be really bad. And that's not how hard drives work. So solid state disks are going to implement a hard drive-like interface despite these limitations. So they're going to solve some of these problems. So they're going to let you read or write whole sectors at a time where the sector is much smaller than erasure blocks. And we're going to do this without using the naive solution of when you write a sector, erase everything around it, then rewrite it, which would work, but would be really inefficient. And we're going to have queues of reads and writes. But when we're doing this, like, we have like two big things we want to hide. We want to make it so the operating system doesn't notice that there's erasure blocks. And by doesn't notice, I mean not just from a what the interface is perspective, but from a performance and reliability perspective. So we want to make it writes be still fast, even though we can't overwrite efficiently. And we want to hide the limit on the number of erases. And our typical scheme for doing this is going to be to add indirection. So I talked about hard drives remapping blocks that were bad. We're going to remap everything so we can move data around on the disk in order to spread the writes out across erasure blocks to hide the issue of one erasure block, you know, being used too much, or us accidentally putting data in an erasure block that we want to overwrite right away. So let's look at how that might work. So in our Flash controller, we're going to have our OS sector numbers mapped to actual locations on the flash. So the OS provides its logical sector numbers like it does for the hard drive. And we're going to map that, each of those, to some location in our actual flash chips. And I'm going to say I have my flash chips here, and the flash chip in hardware is divided into these flash pages. And these pages are organized into erasure blocks. So these pages 0 to 63, that's like maybe they're 4K each. They're units that we can read at once. But to erase them, we need to erase this whole set of things. And I've color-coded sort of these pages in three different ways. So we have active data that's in blue here. And that represents data where it actually maps to data that is being used. We also have gray, which represents unused space. So what happened here is previously we were storing some data here, but then we decided to overwrite it. And in order not to erase blocks too much, what we did instead of overwriting it in place is that we wrote a new copy of it somewhere else and just stopped using this part of the flash chip. Then we have this yellow region, which represents erase data that's ready to write. So after we erase, we can write the data once. So this yellow region is where we can actually write without erasing. So the way we're going to use this mapping, so let's talk about reading first. Reading's the simplest thing here. So the OS says, hey, I want to read sector 31. So this is our OS, and this is the, you know, flash hardware, and the flash hardware looks up and says, oh, that's in page 74. It goes to the appropriate part of the flash chip, returns that data. Now, let's say the OS wants to write something. So here, the OS wanted to write sector 32, which was previously stored over here. What we're going to do is we're going to mark this as unused, and write what the OS was trying to write over here in a new location that is, you know, was previously erased, so it's ready to be written once. Okay. So that's reading and writing. Now, this scheme seems fine, except you may observe that we have this problem that eventually we're going to run out of erase space, and we somehow have to make more. So we're going to solve that in a bit, but first questions on this remapping and this idea of moving written data to a new location. So, does the solid state disk controller arbitrarily store newly available locations to write to? So, I'm not sure what you're asking. Like, is it, like, you're asking how does it choose this? Or are you asking, like, how does it track what this region is? How does it choose that? So, it's going to have to... It knows when it erased previously, so it has some sort of data structure that tracks like what pages it could allocate for newly written things. And I'm sort of giving a simplified version. How you efficiently do all this turns out to be, have lots of interesting choices, and this is a reason why SSDs vary a lot by manufacturer. Does that answer your question? So let's go to our problem of, well, I'm going to keep adding stuff here and eventually I'm going to run out of erase space to write stuff. And what I'd really like to do is free up some space. So let's say arbitrarily, I'd like to free up this space. And the problem is, well, I can't free up that space because some of it's being used. Some of it's blue, meaning there's data in there that I need to save. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to copy that data first to space I can write. So I'm going to take all this active data, the non-unused data, and place it in something I've already erased. And once I do that, I can safely erase this entire erasure block. And this is how I free up space. So I just keep doing that. And this should let me actually keep going, you know, as long as I need to. And there's some cost here because it turns out freeing up this new space required doing a bunch of copying. So this is not like quite as efficient as the maximum speed we can write things because of all that extra copying. So questions on this idea. And this procedure is known as garbage collection because we're freeing up space. And basically, the space we're freeing up is we're saying, I have this unused space I want to clear. How do I do that? Well, to do that, I need to move the stuff around it out of the way, and then I can free up that space to be reused. Okay. Questions about scheme? So, yeah, that's our what we call block remapping. So we have that mapping from sector to a location in the flash. The sector is the OS idea, and this is the location in the flash is the hardware. We move the writes to a new sector, and we have when they're written, and we eventually do this garbage collection to free up space so we don't run out of space to read. And doing this efficiently turns out to be very complicated because, like, there's questions of why would I do I have to choose this one? Where do I write all my data here or here? Can I like try to keep data together to do less erasures? You know, when do I do this? Like, how do I stay ahead of the program? So there's all sorts of interesting and complicated decisions to do this efficiently, which is why SSDs often have a pretty complicated real processor. Question is, when do erasures happen? Is it when the SSD detects it's going to need more erase write memory? So presumably, yes. And like, there's a big question about what would you do for like There's multiple choices about when you do that. Like, one thing the SSD probably would like to do is that it would like to do this copying here when it's not being actively used, so it can be faster when there are reads or writes coming in. And that's sort of a complicated trade-off. Does that answer your question? Okay. So, given that we know how block remapping works, let's have a question here. So, let's say I have three different sorts of files or data on disk I'm talking about, and we're assuming a FAT-like file system, and I'm asking, if this file system is using an SSD that does block remapping like I talked about, which of these are likely to end up being stored in either the same erasure block or a very tiny number of erasure blocks, given what block remapping is doing? I'll give you, some time to think about this. Give another 30 seconds or so. Okay, so we have absolutely no consensus. So let me go over sort of my thoughts. I'll start with this first one. So here I'm saying we have the data clusters of a set of log files in one directory, and let's say ROS was smart enough to assign them a contiguous range of cluster numbers. So it said, hey, you're gonna access these log files together, let's give them contiguous cluster numbers. But remember that those contiguous cluster numbers, this is what the OS numbers correspond to. It doesn't mean they're actually nearby in the flash. So my intuition would be that together in the flash, if written at similar times, so I'd say probably not together, but maybe the flash controller tries to put together on garbage collection. So maybe the flash controller might try to be a little smart when it does garbage collection and move the things together, guessing they'll be accessed together and erased together, more importantly. But they're not written at the same time, so there's not a natural way for the data to end up in the same area, even though they have similar sector numbers. Because remember, the sector numbers is only that left side. It's the other numbers are assigned as things are written, and things written at similar times should end up in similar places. And because things written at similar times should end up together, I would say that these images would end up together, because remember, cluster numbers, are the OS idea, which doesn't equal the hardware locations. So the hardware is going to assign locations together. It's going to put them in whatever erasure blocks it's writing to now. because they're all written at a similar time, and it's not going to erase extra things if it doesn't need to. So these images will probably end up in a similar erasure block, even though, you know, they're written to different sector numbers on the disk because of this indirection. Finally, we have the FAT. Now, the FAT is stored in adjacent sector numbers. So on a hard drive, it would, in fact, would be close together. But because, you know, written at lots of times, like different parts of the FAT are written at different times, applies probably different parts of the flash. And given that this is overwritten all the time, like little pieces of it, it may even be hard for, even if the flash controller wants to try to rearrange things on garbage collection, this is being overwritten in little pieces all the time, so that probably won't end up happening. So probably the entries of the FAT will not be stored all in one erasure block, just because, you know, they're, each time a new part is overwritten, that's going to be stored in a new location, and we'll have a whole bunch of new locations. So there are questions on my reasoning about how these would work out? Okay, so now that we sort of have an idea how SSDs work, let's talk about what this means from a performance point of view. So because we don't have moving parts, SSDs are way faster than hard drives. With hard drives, we talked about seek time and rotational latency. That meant that we had often had many milliseconds for reads and writes, and an SSD reads and writes are typically sub-milliseconds. Also, because we don't have moving parts, things being close together mostly doesn't matter because we don't have to wait for disks to rotate or heads to move. Now, because we're doing this complicated translation from what the OS tells the disk and what the actual flash is doing, the performance can depend a lot on the controller. Because, you know, how that block remapping works is going to affect performance. And in particular, garbage collection, the process of freeing up erasure blocks to write, can cause some big changes in performance. So for example, when almost all of the SSD is full, garbage collection is, in a sense, is more challenging because the controller probably needs to move data around a lot to free up erasure blocks. And, you know, also erasing erasure blocks is kind of slow, so we ideally would not like to be doing it on writes. So that's sort of what our performance is. You know, so reads are sub-millisecond, writes are usually sub-millisecond, but if we have to do a lot of work to move data around to make that write happen, they might not be. Or at least we'll end up being slower on average. So I've talked about SSDs implementing this hard drive interface. SSDs sometimes implement some non-hard drive operations. So even though we're kind of pretending they're hard drives, we've slowly come to a realization that maybe that's not the greatest idea. And we've at least made some strides to have OSs like take advantage of how SSDs work. And probably the most notable one is an operation called trim. And trim is a way for the operating system to say, I'm not using this sector anymore. And the reason why this is something that's handy for an SSD is that, you know, with a hard drive, if we're not using a sector anymore, well, it's still a physical part of the disk, it's going to have data, it doesn't matter. With an SSD, if we're not using a sector anymore, what we can do is we can go to our table here, and the OSA says, I'm not using sector 31 anymore. We just cross out this mapping and put some sort of null value. And that's going to make things easier as far as, you know, freeing up space for erasure blocks. We can avoid copying things, and it can be a lot more efficient. And this is sort of a way that, you know, we can have a slightly better interface. And there might be some other operations you might imagine where, if we were designing with SSDs in mind, we might want to talk to them differently. So questions on SSD operations? Okay. So that's most of my talk about storage hardware, unless there are questions. I have one final note about future technologies. So there are technologies which have been, look like they might happen eventually for future storage technologies, which are somewhere in between memory and SSDs. So there are things which have a read-or-write interface kind of like DRAM, meaning byte-oriented, not like SSDs and hard drives where you have to read much bigger units and write much bigger units, which are in between DRAM and SSDs in speed, but are persistent, meaning don't lose data on shutdown. And with capacities like similar to or larger than DRAM. And it's sort of an open question of what should file systems look like for this new technology, and not one I have an answer to. I'm kind of one that the research community has been slowly exploring, assuming that maybe eventually this will happen. I'm not a hardware person, can't give you good predictions about when, but people have been talking about this as sort of something on the like 5 to 10 year horizon. Okay, so now that we've talked about hardware technologies, let's look at a file system that is not that. We're gonna talk about X86's file system. So X86's file system is kind of a toy file system, but its overall design is very similar to modern Unix file systems. So the high-level design is very much like what the Linux file system does. And it does some things better than FAT. So one thing it does better than FAT is it does continuous reads better than FAT. It's going to use something more like an array to store where file locations are rather than a linked list, and that's going to be better for easily, you know, not skipping around the disk a bunch. It's also going to be better at handling crashes. We'll talk about that probably next time. Now, there's some terminology differences. So this is just one terminology difference. Is that we're going to divide the disk into what we'll call blocks instead of clusters, but the meaning is the same. I'm going to use the term blocks, so this is consistent with all the literature you'll see about this style of file system. Now, an actual difference in layout is rather than having one table which tells us about where file data is and where blocks are, we're going to kind of separate that out into separate tables. And I'll show you what that is with our disk layout. So here's how XV6 lays out the disk. So like the FAT file system, we have a header. XV6 calls this the super block, and it takes up a whole block, even though that we don't actually use all this space. So we use a small part of the block, but we reserve the whole block for it. And a block here, this is going to be, XV6 has chosen to make this one sector, so 512 bytes. So our super block contains general information that lets you find, you know, the layout of the disk. So like the FAT header told us, like, where's the FAT, how big is it? This tells us the same kind of information. You know, how many blocks do we have? Where are each of these starting locations? And so on. Okay. So then we have these different regions of the disk which store different data. So we have this log, and this is for reliability. We'll talk about that next time. We have these inode array. So the inode array is where we store metadata about files. So in FAT, we kind of split the information about files in between the FAT, where we store information about the location of a file's blocks, and the directory entry where we stored metadata like the size, modification times, and so on. Here, we're going to store most of the file information all in one structure that we call an inode. So in XV6, the inode tells us what type of file is it. Is it a directory or a regular file or a device file? If it's a device file, we have the number of the device, we have the size of the file, and we have the actual locations of its data as a fixed size array. I'll get to some questions you're going to have about this fixed size array in a bit. There's also this nlink. So that's the number of what we call hard links to the file. Terminology-wise, we call a directory entry that points to a particular inode, a hard link. We can have multiple of them, it turns out, which is why there's a counter here. So besides the hard link, we have this list of locations of data, and the basic idea is that if the file's data is in block 11 and 14, we'll store 11 and 14 in this array, and we'll have as many entries as up to the size of the file. And you're going to complain that, wait a moment, how big is ndirect? And you're going to be disappointed when I tell you it's 12, and you'll say, so our files can only be 13 blocks, which is, if you do your calculations, 6.5 kilobytes. And the answer is no, we're going to do something special, and we'll talk about that in a bit. Okay, so that's how we store file metadata, except for we don't have a file name. So like in FAT, we're going to store file names in directory entries, which are the data for a directory file. But our directory entries aren't going to store all that other file metadata. Instead, our directory entries are going to look like this. They're going to have an index into the inode array and a name. That's it. If we want to find out the size of the file and so on, we go to the inode array. It's all stored together, which means that we're keeping more of our reads and writes together on the disk. So that's the inodes and how we point to them. Another thing we have is this free block map. So we need to keep track of what blocks are used. In fact, we kind of had something which served as pointer to the next block, or if the block wasn't used, an indicator that it was free. In XV6's file system, we separately track what blocks are free. So we just have a bitmap of what blocks are free. We also need to keep track of what inodes are free. The solution XV6 uses is that we set its type field to 0. In other Unix file systems, they often have a free inode map, which is, again, just an array of bits, rather, to make it faster to find a free inode. Here, we have to scan the whole inode array. That actually is kind of slow. We'd like to avoid that, just like we like to, so we can find an inode quickly. Talking about directory entries. And since XV6 has a concrete implementation, I can answer a question about what XV6 does that I couldn't answer for FAT. So for FAT, we talked about how things are on disk, but we didn't talk about, for example, if I create a new file, I had to say, we choose what blocks to use for it somehow. But XV6, we have code, we know exactly the one way it chooses how to assign an inode or data block, and its solution is linear search. It takes the first ones that are free. And if you're thinking about this and what we talked about with hard drives, you might think, well, that means that file data might not actually be together on the disk, and that's exactly a problem we have. We might talk about, you know, you could do better than that. XV6 is just doing the simplest thing. So questions about our overall XV6 sort of file layout, besides the issue of large files. Okay, so we have our file layout. Let's talk about how we detect where files are. So in our inode, so this is an inode, this is in the inode, and this is the file's data. we have block pointers. So these are numbers of the data blocks for the file. And for the first 12 blocks, which is equal 6 kilobytes of the file, we have pointers to those blocks by their numbers in the inode. So we look up the inode based on its number in the directory entry, and we get its data blocks for the first 12. After that, we want to support big files, so we add a layer of indirection. So we have here a pointer to this indirect block, and this contains 512 divided by 2. So 512 bytes divided by 2 bytes for a block number, 256 pointers to indirect blocks. And it's 256 because each block is 512 bytes, each pointer is 2 bytes, because that's the size of a block number that XV6 has chosen. And this contains the sort of next 256 blocks, or 128 kilobytes. And we just use as many of these as we need to store the size of the file. So unlike FAT, we're storing the information about where the parts of the file are in one place, so we can hopefully get this in a small number of disk reads, which maybe is more efficient. So questions about this scheme? So if we think about what this means for our files, since we have 512 byte blocks and 2 byte block pointers, so the indirect pointer, that last pointer, can reference 128K. Our first pointer does 6K. So this gives us a maximum file size of 128 plus 6K, which is 134K kilobytes, which for XV6, that's kind of fine. That's a toy teaching OS, but this seems a little disappointing if you were like trying to use this like for your laptop or desktop, because gosh, how do I save a movie in 134K? That's really bad. So let's look at the similar scheme that a real file system uses, which is the Linux file system. So here's an excerpt from the Linux extended to file system, which is used to be the most popular Linux file system. These days, it's extended 4, probably. So this contains much the same data we've seen in XV6. It's not obvious that it's all the same. We have a mode here. This includes the type information you saw in XV6, directory or not. We have some extra data like owners and modification times. But the core stuff is the same. We have our type. We have size and so on. A size, and we have pointers to blocks of a certain number, but this supports much bigger files. So a question might be, how do we do that? And the answer is, we use more indirection. So this is how it works in extended 2. We have 15 pointers, so that's not many more. And these are in the inode. And here is our data for the file. So the first 12 pointers, like in XV6, 12 are our direct pointers. And like in XV6, we have our next pointer is an indirect pointer. So it points to a, block of pointers. But after that, we want to support much bigger files. What's our solution? We have a double indirect pointer. So it points to a block of pointers to pointers to blocks of pointers. So we have two layers of indirection. And then we have a triple indirect pointer with three layers of indirection. And we could extend this scheme if we wanted to support even bigger files. Okay. And I think I'm out of time, basically, but let's like here, let's do a last exercise. So this is what extended two supports. So since I'm out of time, I will go over the answer to this exercise. So let's say we have 1K blocks and 4-byte block pointers, and we're using this scheme. So we have 12 direct pointers. So this is the first 12K of the file. This is in inode. We have one indirect pointer. So this points to 256. 1 kilobyte. So, kilobyte divided by 4 equals 256 blocks, which means that this is the next 256 KB. This double indirect pointer points to 256 blocks that point to 256 blocks. So this is the next 256 times 256 times 1K per block bytes. And similarly here, we have 256 times 256 times 256. That's the number of blocks pointed to times 1K per block. So that's where I'm going to leave off. I'll take questions on this. Scheme generally. Okay. Any questions? Okay, I guess not. So see you next Tuesday.